virtual learning. It's been the hallmark of this pandemic for kids. Some state officials want it to come to an end in 2021. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, could Duval County students be forced back into brick and mortar class next year? Let us know your thoughts and questions about this. It's 549-2937. Then later, we've got an update on the Emerald Trail. That's the new greenbelt planned to encircle the city of Jax. But first this hour, the latest on the pandemic. The U.S. now has more than 11.2 million cases of coronavirus, with a death toll at 247,100. At the same time, here in Florida, we added 4,600 new cases Monday in the Department of Health's report. That's just one day after the state recorded its largest single-day increase in cases since mid-summer. The death toll in Florida now stands at 17,559, with nearly 900,000 reported cases statewide. So coronavirus is going up across the state, just as it is across the country. And of course, this school year has been upended by the pandemic, with thousands of kids learning remotely across our area, even though more students have opted to go back to brick and mortar class. In the Duval County Public Schools, virtual learning is called Duval Homeroom for these students. But the state may seek to end this arrangement at the end of 2020, about halfway through the school year. Could Duval Homeroom be coming to an end? What's the latest with virtual learning in our city? Emily Block of the Florida Times Union is an education reporter at the paper who's been covering this, and she's on the line to bring us up to date. Hi, Emily. Good morning.
Hi, Melissa. How are you doing?
Great, thanks. Already getting tweets about this. What are your thoughts and questions about virtual learning here on the First Coast for your kids? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. All right. So as I just mentioned, Emily, COVID cases are spiking in our area and across the country. But at the same time, you're learning that state education officials may seek to end virtual learning in January. What's the latest on this?
Right. So this is something that we've heard rumbling for months now, right? When virtual school started, when the school year started, there was an executive order from the Florida Department of Education that said that schools needed to open 5 days a week brick and mortar, but they could do a virtual option or some sort of innovative learning, is their phrasing, if it's approved by their local health department and they get, you know, the situation in place. Separately, we learned that school districts are being stonewalled by their local health departments under Surgeon General warnings, saying that they shouldn't be working with their school department districts that basically in a way to force or bottleneck schools into opening. The Duval schools got approval on their virtual model, partly because of the Republican National Convention coming to town at the time, even though that ended up getting canceled. Now, that executive order that allowed for these innovative learning models is going to expire in December, and that hasn't been extended yet. So until we know what's happening there, no one knows if virtual school is going to continue in January.
The Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran said at the Department of Education meeting last month, and I'm quoting from your story in the Times Union, "We've got to get those kids in the classroom," and said he would probably announce by Thanksgiving what the plan is for how these students will be educated in the new year. So should we expect some news around Thanksgiving?
You know, if the past has taught us anything, it's that these timelines are very arbitrary. So I really highly doubt that the week that all schools are closed across the state is going to be the week where we hear news. It just doesn't usually work that way. Maybe the week after, I'm hoping, but I kind of doubt it personally, but that's my opinion. Maybe they'll surprise us and be right on time. But I mean, I imagine it would hopefully be at least the week after that, so parents and families and teachers can start planning, just because that's not a lot of time.
Yeah.
It's not a lot of time. And to your point, those are the words right from Richard Corcoran's mouth, the Department of Education state commissioner. Him and Governor Ron DeSantis have been, it's no secret that they want students back in classrooms. They've been very vocal about the need for in-person education. At the same time, Governor DeSantis has said at pretty much every education panel he's hosted or roundtable or briefing that he's so proud that we're offering options in Florida and that parents are able to choose if they want to continue virtual schooling. So it will be interesting if they completely turn around on that.
Let's talk about other counties. In St. John's County, the superintendent there said leaders will no longer allow students to move from brick-and-mortar learning to distance learning. So it's,
we're seeing that across a bunch of districts, actually, even Duval to an extent, where it was getting to, because they're not doing synchronous learning, it's either you're in one or the other, it was becoming a headache for schedules. So even Duval Schools has it implemented where if you're in Duval homeroom by now, you were allowed to go back now, but if you're in brick and mortar, they're saying that you can't go back to virtual. And even if you're in Duval homeroom, they're strongly advising against changing it up now or like in the middle of the semester. But I have a feeling that they'll still maybe make exceptions at beginning and ends of quarters.
The risk is real for those who have concerns. We do need to stress that teachers and educators do continue to die of this disease. In Clay County, a teacher died from COVID-19 complications. It's the second death of a district employee in Clay in the past 2 months. 59-year-old Tim Clyatt of Fleming Island taught computer science in the district. He died on Friday, November 13th after a week in the hospital. And friends of Clyatt said he was just a few years away from retiring, Emily, and they voiced frustration with people not wearing masks and also their school district's lack of transparency about COVID-19 cases. So, you know, as you've been reporting for many months now, most students are not at risk of dying from COVID. That said, there are parents out there that want to keep this option for their students. Teachers and school staff do continue to face a risk of contracting the disease. And, you know, we are close, apparently, to a COVID vaccine in this country. But at the same time, this winter is expected to be deadly for COVID-19. So is it, are you getting feedback from people in the educational community that they feel it would be irresponsible to end the option of virtual learning in January, given all of these factors?
Absolutely. Given these factors, given the spread of the virus and the fact that cases are going in the wrong direction, Melissa, I'm hearing a lot of hesitancy and frustration from educators saying, like, this is a terrible time to make these decisions. We have more cases now and a higher percentage positivity right now than we did when schools initially locked down and closed shop back in March of last year. Of course, it's also worth noting that besides just the risk of it all, it's putting an additional burden on teachers because the way the classrooms have been set up and the class models have been set up, it was for, you know, a certain number of teachers were hired for in-person and a certain number are in virtual versions and a certain number are doing both. So it's going to wreak havoc on class sizes and planning and curriculums all across Florida.
And if a child has been virtual all through the school year, it would be jarring for them to suddenly be put back in the classroom. It's also my understanding their class schedules might change in a lot of cases. So let's go to some calls now for Emily Block of the Florida Times Union. She covers education at the paper. What are your thoughts about school districts ending virtual learning in January here in Florida? It's 549-2937. Jonathan is in Middleburg. Hi, Jonathan. Good morning.
Hey, Melissa. I'm currently a full-time employee working at home right now. I have three girls with me here and a kindergartner. And as much as I want to keep them at home with me, we're literally doing the school from 7 o'clock to 3 o'clock with my daughter, and it's just affecting my job. So as much as I am hesitant to send them back to school with the rise of the coronavirus cases going up, we are making the decision to send both of our elementary school children back to school.
Yeah, I completely understand, Jonathan. Thanks for your call. Emily, let's talk for a minute about the incredible strain this whole situation has placed on families, especially parents of young children like Jonathan, who are trying to educate their children virtually, get them in front of a computer screen for hours every day, little kids. I mean, I certainly can't blame Jonathan for that decision.
No, of course not. And I think we need to emphasize that there is no wrong answer. The whole point was that Florida was supposed to have options for whatever best worked for each family. And it would be a shame if we saw that go away. But no, I'm hearing, especially from elementary school aged parents, that they're considering sending their children back because it is a full-time job. And if they're also juggling a full-time job, it's just they want to make sure that their child is getting the attention and the education that they deserve. And that's not what they signed up for. So we're seeing that a lot.
549-2937. Let us know your thoughts as virtual learning could come to an end in Florida in January for students. This depends on what state education officials decide. Brian is in San Marco. Hi, Brian. Good morning.
Hey, Melissa. Good morning. How are you?
All right. Thanks.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a parent with my wife and I both work. We've got three kids. And, you know, we're very happy that the governor has decided to support us and have the schools open because it's really impossible for us both to work and homeschool three children. You know, and this virus can't dominate our life. I really think that people need to wake up and realize the fear that's being pushed by the media is a little over the top. So let's all just calm down, take a deep breath. We'll all get through this, take precautions, and everything will be fine. You know, I really appreciate Governor DeSantis, and his leadership has been very bold. Florida has been very steadfast and strong in this and not, you know, giving in to the fear mob. And that's pretty much all.
Well, Brian, thanks for your call. I would push back only to say that we're not trying to foment fear on this program anyway, but simply to report the news. And Emily, what about Brian's point of view?
Yes. Well, first off, to your point, Melissa, I resent that statement a little bit just because, I mean, I'm doing my job. We're not fear-mongering. If anything, we're exactly to your point. We're reporting the news. And I would push back and say, I don't know if Florida is being steadfast when even in Jacksonville, we saw an all-time record high in cases in 4 months over on Sunday, you know, on a weekend when typically the cases reported are a low batch. So I don't know what that really says. But to his point about the importance of schools needing to open, yes, we're hearing that from a lot of parents. I think what's worth emphasizing is that's been that way from the beginning of the school year. What parents are concerned about is if the option for online schools goes away.
Yeah, and it would seem to me that maybe education officials are floating this idea to see how it plays. And if they get a lot of pushback, they might pull it back. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting observation. And I could see where that could be the case, especially because when I talked to the Department of Education, they told me the same thing. They told me that they took surveys in October, which we've requested, from each school district across Florida to see the number of students that are doing virtual school and other data of that essence. And I guess they are looking at all of that to get a bigger picture. And even they're the first to say that, like, virtual school can't just immediately disappear if it's a sizable number that are participating in it. So I think, yes, to an extent, they are looking and weighing options. And as we've seen in the past, if parents are making enough, you know, noise, if they're voicing their concerns, I do think that they are taking that into some consideration.
And Emily, to be clear, the majority of parents around our region have their children in brick and mortar school, but it's about at least a third or so of kids who are still learning virtually. Is that right?
Yes. So I think statewide, 40% are in some sort of virtual option, but I think that might include some hybrid models as well. And then in Duval County, it is, I have the number. I don't know if you can reach it quicker than me, Melissa, in that article. But it's gone down sizably since the beginning of the school year. It started with about a third. It's gone down a little less, but it's, let's see. In Duval County, 80,000 are in brick and mortar, and about 7,500 are in Duval homeroom.
All right. Thanks for that. We're talking with education reporter Emily Block of the Florida Times Union as the state considers pulling the plug on virtual learning in January. State education officials, what do you think about that? It's 549-2937. Aaron in Springfield. Hi, Aaron. How are you?
Hey, good. How are you?
Okay.
Excellent. I just, with this push to go back in person, I wanted to acknowledge the increased reliance on substitute teachers, especially considering the changing standards. So now with the coronavirus, I know Clay County, for example, has reduced the educational backgrounds needed to be able to be a substitute teacher. And Duval County is pulling individuals out of support roles, you know, who are closer to retirement and asking that they return back and fill these substitution roles. And I think that kind of will change the type of educational experience these students are having, not to mention putting additional strain on individuals who are almost forced back into the classroom.
Yeah. Aaron, I've heard that. Emily, how is that affecting the dynamics, the increased reliance on subs?
Yes. Thank you, Aaron. That's such an important point. Absolutely. I mean, we've seen from the very beginning of the school year that it's been hard for teachers to get substitutes in class. I mean, Dr. Diana Green, the superintendent of Duval Schools, said she had 2,000 subs ready in the ranks to go. But even, we, you know, within like 5 weeks or so, teachers were telling me that they were struggling to get subs placed for their classes. It's just there's already such a strain on both sides to get substitutes placed and to even hire them in these conditions, especially to Aaron's point when there are some older support roles that are now getting wrangled into new roles. So it is already so hard. I can't imagine adding this additional strain.
Lots of tweets about this. Here is one from Mark. We are just short-sighted enough to pull the plug at a bad time. He says, another tweet, I hope and pray Duval Homeroom will stay around until we get a vaccine. To say I'm concerned is an understatement. The state is pursuing a thinly veiled herd immunity strategy, and I don't know if Duval schools will stand up for us. She says, she goes on to say, I feel trapped, and I would hate for my child to have to leave her virtual school because the governor decided to make this political, she says. Okay. Emily, what's your reaction to that? Beginning with accusations that the DeSantis administration has been pursuing what's known as a herd immunity strategy for COVID.
Well, we've talked about this from the very beginning, where we've seen that the initiatives that Governor DeSantis is pushing align very tightly with what the Trump administration has been pushing. So it should be interesting to see how that morphs and changes, if at all, when the administration in the president's office transitions. So that's, you know, something to keep an eye on. As far as herd immunity, we know that it does not work with this virus. So, of course, it's very concerning, and I can't imagine being a parent right now to think that maybe without so much as a choice, their student would be yanked into a new model. We also know that it's just they're not going to have the same options, right? So already with virtual school, with Duval Homeroom, you're at least keeping your seat in a magnet school, in an ACE program, in a Cambridge program, in advanced classes, and you probably aren't able to take any of those classes right now. A lot of parents are telling me that this is kind of a throwaway year. But the concern is that if they have to change and turn into a different school altogether because now they're getting pushed back and they don't have a seat at that school anymore, or if their student parent wants to keep them virtual so now they have to transition to Florida Virtual School or Duval, DVIA, Duval Virtual Instruction Academy, they're going to lose that ground altogether in a magnet or an advanced program. That class won't, those programs won't be offered. And now they'll have to either retake credits or, you know, lose those credits. So it gets really messy and complicated to upheave something mid-year like this.
What about the perception some have? I mean, we heard from one caller who really likes the governor's approach. Others see the governor politicizing his response to this virus in the way that you mentioned by aligning himself with the president's approach. How do you see that affecting educational policy?
You know, we're watching that not just statewide, but across the country. how governors are aligning or not aligning with the president's office and how that has affected not only how schools are reopening, but how a state is reopening altogether. I mean, we're seeing states go back into lockdown right now, and I don't imagine Florida's doing that anytime soon. So it should be really interesting and also mildly scary to watch over the next coming months, especially with holiday season.
Exactly right. And as we talked about on this show yesterday, don't go to a big gathering this holiday season, even if you're tempted to.
Please
don't do it. Stephanie in San Marco. Hi, Stephanie.
Hello. I just want to say that I have two children in the school system. They are both going brick and mortar, but I appreciate so much the choice to put them in a virtual program and maintain their magnet spot if that was something that I chose to do. I don't understand how the governor can come up with a rule that pertains to the entire state when each county in Florida has their own school board and they should be able to make those decisions based on what works best for each individual county and each individual school district. And if what we're doing now is working, allowing some children to be home and some children to go to brick and mortar, that in itself is going to keep the case number down because it puts fewer kids in the space together. What they're doing at La Villa with the synchronous learning, I believe, is the best option. And I don't understand why we all don't have that choice. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephanie. And Emily, of course, both the governor and the education commissioner are big proponents of choice and options for parents. So a top-down order on this might seem to fly in the face of that kind of philosophy.
Yeah, it's really funny, isn't it? That's totally... It might completely change, contrary to everything that they've been touting this entire year and then some. I think Stephanie's comment is really valid, and I appreciate it. That yes, to an extent, this is working the best they can, while also maintaining that parents can do what's best for their families. Because, you know, I'm talking to parents across the district, and I talk to some in the story, Melissa, that they tell me that, you know, Duval homeroom is hard for them, and it's hard on them while they're dealing with a full-time job. And it's not an ideal situation, but because of their family dynamic, because someone might have, someone might be immunocompromised in their family, it's what's best for them right now. So the idea of taking that away is obviously really concerning for them. And then to Stephanie's point of the synchronous learning at La Villa, it would be really cool to see that spread district-wide. It's not something that every school is doing right now. Every school is taking the model that they have and kind of putting their own spin on it based on their strengths, if they're a magnet school, etc. And we are really seeing some of the arts schools just thrive in this and get really creative with how their lesson plans are going and how they're teaching. So that's been pretty fun to watch.
Something else to point out, one-third of American children live in extended family households, meaning they live with older Americans, seniors. So that is a factor in the spread of this virus. Chris in St. John's County. Hi, Chris.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. Hey, ladies. I have a unique perspective for this. I am a pastor here in Duval County. I am a dad of two in St. John's County, married to a teacher that works in St. John's County. So I get to see both sides of this mm-hmm. stuff on Sunday morning and coming home talking to my wife every single day during the week. And one of the things that she just reiterates every time is how hard the teachers are working to make this work and her cohorts at her school. Not only that, but we are at the, Florida is at the, is late to the game, so to speak, in this national wave of pandemic hitting us right now. And I think we're inching really close to coming to play to these numbers that we're seeing across the country. And to do what they are floating is asinine.
And you know, and Chris, you're so right. Teachers like your wife are heroes. I cannot say enough good things about the
Absolutely.
Work of teachers in this crisis. You are so correct. And tell your wife thanks from all of us. And I am, you know, just as you are, Chris, I'm worried about this third wave of the virus washing over Florida, too. So thank you so much, Chris. And, you know, I appreciate that call. You know, Emily, teachers are no different than police, firefighters, EMTs, doctors, nurses. They are frontline workers in this whole mess, and they are doing amazing things, and they're putting themselves at risk to educate our kids, and then layering in teaching some virtually, some physically in front of them. It's just unbelievably difficult for all of them, and so we do owe them thanks.
I couldn't say it better myself, Melissa. Yes, they're absolutely heroes, and it is so incredibly hard. It's thankless work. It's underpaid work, and it now more than ever, you know, we're doing multiple and synchronous lesson plans, online lesson plans, and in-person lesson plans, keeping up with the grading in both models. It is insane, and is often thankless.
Let's get a couple more calls in. Yvonne on the South Side. Hi, Yvonne.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I just want people to remember all the people they've seen in the community acting irresponsibly, that even refuse to wear masks or wear them under their noses still. And I want parents to have a choice now more than ever, because the pandemic is on a surge and we're still part of the community. And if we can get past some of the political differences enough to care more about each other, care about our teachers, care about our students, and let's keep some vigilance and not forget where we are and what's happening.
Thank you so much, Yvonne. You're absolutely right. Thank you. And Jason in San Marco. Go ahead, Jason.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning.
You know, hey, you had a caller who called in and supported DeSantis' position, and, you know, that's a widely held opinion, very widely held. And I want to go back a step and tie in a little bit of the political rhetoric that we've heard from our president. He said COVID was behind us, and he also viciously attacked our public schools in general over and over again. It's really sad, I think, and I think it's totally untrue. And I think the only way you're going to change the minds of that gentleman who called in and supported DeSantis, and I'm reading through the lines that he's probably a Trump supporter as well, I'm not going to vilify the guy. I'm just going to say, go down to the hospital and check out the COVID ward, and then go to the morgue and say, show me all the people that have died. Because until those people see that actual hard and cold evidence of how deadly this disease is, they're not going to change their behavior. I'm not vilifying the guy. I'm just saying he needs, you know, if he had to take his daughter, one of his beautiful children that he mentioned, to the hospital and they say, we don't have any room because it's all filled up with COVID patients, that would maybe be the kind of evidence that would change his mind. He did say we need to be responsible, so I hope he's being responsible. I cannot stand wearing the mask, but I do it. And my daughter and my wife remind me to do it all the time. I'm looking forward to being past this whole thing, but I get it. And you know what? No one in my family's caught it. And I have a family of four, and we are very glad that we haven't gotten sick. Anyway, that's my two cents. And thanks again for
all right,
show.
Yeah.
It's really a great way for the community to chime in.
Thank you, Jason. Thanks for being responsible. Glad you and yours are well, too. Okay, Emily, we've had a robust look at this issue. So as we wrap this up, what can we expect to hear from our local superintendents about this at the end of the year?
You know, that is a good question, and I've asked the same question to them. They are watching and waiting for the time being. They say that Duval Homeroom isn't going anywhere for the time being, pending a change in the executive order. So it's kind of a when they hear something, we'll know something. But in the meantime, we're all kind of just waiting with bated breath, Melissa.
Well, we will continue to read your work in the Times Union for updates. Everyone subscribe to the TU to read Emily Block and her colleagues in the Florida Times Union. Emily, thanks.
I appreciate it. Have a good day.
Much more still ahead. Later, you can enjoy some tasty roasted oysters this weekend and support the St. John's River. We'll tell you how. But up next,
I think people are really curious about how to start a farming endeavor. You know, in Duval County, we have 366 farms, many of them home farms on 30,000 acres. So we're a thriving urban district.
Yeah, how you can become a First Coast farmer, even if you live in the middle of the city. That's next.
Join WJCT for Voices of the First Coast, one small step across the political divide, a nationwide project with the goal of breaking down boundaries between strangers. At this free event, you'll hear from StoryCorps founder Dave Isay, listen to excerpts from select conversations recorded across the First Coast, and engage in discussion with participants. Join us on Thursday, November 19th at 7 p.m. This virtual event is free, but reservations are required. Information at wjct.org/events.
Turntable Tuesday can now be heard on Anthology on the WJCT app and 89.9 HD3. For the best on vinyl, listen to Anthology Tuesdays at 9. Turntable Tuesday, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
Welcome back. Well, one of the fascinating things about our First Coast is the growing farm-to-table movement and the strong community-supported agriculture that we enjoy here. You can be a farmer, too. Yeah, you really can, even if you live in the city. The Duval County Soil and Water Conservation District is holding a panel discussion and a virtual market today. It's called Start Farming. Here's Jennifer Casey from the district. Hey, Jennifer, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, we hear a lot about the Duval County Soil and Water Conservation Commission, which is a long name for a body that does some important work, but not everyone understands what soil and water is all about. Tell us a little bit about what you're up to and this farming workshop that you're hosting this month.
Sure. Well, Soil and Water Conservation Districts were formed, as you probably know, after the Dust Bowl days, and our conservation district here in Duval was organized by concerned citizens to help landowners and users conserve land, water, forests, wildlife, and other resources. And we meet monthly to hear reports from our affiliate agencies, learn about conservation funding priorities in the district, and develop programs and educational opportunities that really meet the needs of conservation in Duval County. So our Start Farming panel discussion and virtual market is one of those workshops that we're having. So we're super excited to tell you about it.
Okay, so what's on the agenda and who's going to be taking part in all this?
We have four panelists this year. Every year we like to feature local farms. And so we have Caria Hawkins from Abundant Harvest Farm in Baker County. She has a four-acre sustainable farm that started as a family co-op and has turned into a commercial farm. We have Panita Patel from Backyard Buffalo in St. Johns County, and she owns a micro dairy operation with Water Buffalo, and she sells buffalo milk dairy products. We also have Jesse Fisk from Juicy Roots Farm and Homestead in Northwest Jacksonville, and she grows herbs and salad greens and goes really beyond organic standards. And finally, we have Amy Kessler from Front Porch Picking. She doesn't have a farm herself, but she has a farm-to-table delivery service. And so we really wanted to highlight the power of community-supported agriculture.
Community-supported agriculture has taken off all over the world, all over the country, and really here on the First Coast. Lots of artisanal products coming out of this area. The farm-to-table movement is really strong. Permaculture, aquaculture, hydroponic products, all this stuff. Why do you think this has really grown, a sector that has grown so much in our region?
You know, this is the fourth year that we have done this event, and each year our attendance increases. We already have 130 registrations for this year, where we've added breakout sessions this year. I think people are really curious about how to start a farming endeavor. You know, in Duval County, we have 366 farms, many of them home farms on 30,000 acres. So we're a thriving urban district. But we have a lot of curiosity about it. So we're going to be having breakout sessions like finding money for farming, sustainability, composting, permaculture, and building healthy communities. And we're not going to answer every question about how to start a farming endeavor, but we are going to start the conversation. And we're going to help make sure that people that are interested have a chance to meet with others who have already done what it is that they're trying to do and can get connected to agency personnel who have funding and assistance for them.
So how can people zoom onto this and check it all out?
Okay, well, thanks to a partnership with Clay County Soil and Water Conservation District and Native Jacks, we're able to offer the event for free. So we're excited to have you register by clicking on the Start Farming link on our website, DuvalSoilAndWater.com, or you can find us on Facebook at Jacks Soil and Water.
Easy enough. Jennifer Casey with Duval's Soil and Water Conservation Commission. Thanks so much for letting us know all about it.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we're keeping our focus on the great outdoors now as we get an update on the Emerald Trail. This is the coolest thing. It's going to be a walkable and bikeable green belt that will transform Jacksonville's urban core. It's going to link together everything from schools to colleges to parks to restaurants, retail, and business. A green belt that goes all the way around the city. Now, the first segment, it's called the La Villa Link, will break ground early next year and be completed by early 2022. And this weekend, there's a 5K happening to benefit Groundwork Jacksonville. They've created the concept for the Emerald Trail and are going to bring it to life. Right now, we're pleased to welcome Kay Ehouse, CEO of Groundwork Jax. Hi, Kay.
Hi, Melissa.
And Amanda Crawford. She's VP of Community Engagement and Sponsorship at Vistar Credit Union. Hey, Amanda.
Good morning.
Good morning to you both. Kay, let's start with you. Tell us about your Emerald Trail and your vision for it. What can we expect to see when it's all completed?
Well, I think you can expect to see a whole lot less concrete everywhere we go.
Yeah.
And have those areas greened up, more trees. We're really looking to have both function and beauty. We think both are important, and there's no reason you can't have both. And I think you'll see some areas for people to congregate and enjoy nature. You'll also have some active recreation along the way as we connect to parks. With the La Villa Link, we're connecting to the Florida Dwight Park, and the Parks Department is actually improving that park along with the trail. So those are the kinds of things that you're just going to see some incredible, incredible spaces.
This is really going to transform the city. And this whole concept of an Emerald Trail, it's been done in other cities too, hasn't it? The closest one that I know of is Atlanta, where there's a green belt that goes all the way around the city that is really popular.
It is incredibly popular and has actually added over $4 billion in economic development since they've started building that trail. And they're creating new parks along the way with that trail.
Okay, so Amanda, why did Vistar Credit Union decide to support the Emerald Trail?
Thank you, Melissa. We have a firm commitment to downtown revitalization, number one. And the other aspect of it is that the Emerald Trail is going to provide significant health, recreation, and as Kay said, social and economic benefits to Jacksonville, especially to some of our underserved neighborhoods in the urban core. We really honestly couldn't be prouder to be a sponsor of the Emerald Trail and look forward to this becoming even a race series that we're supporting.
And when we talk about the urban core and transformation, by linking different neighborhoods together in a walkable way or on your bike or even your skates and making it a green belt, planting stuff all along, how do you see that affecting neighborhoods? And how do you see that, Amanda, as a piece of economic development for the city?
I encourage everyone to come out and just really check this first mile out and really see some of the good things that they already have in place. And I know that Kay can speak to this, but they have bee houses along the way. They have some local herb gardens growing that are open for the communities. It's really beyond that. There's also the art and culture that is really being celebrated along this mile. So they're having focus groups, they're talking directly to the communities to plan out art that is reflective of the area. And some of the murals that are along the way are just breathtaking. And you cannot appreciate them in pictures. You got to get out there and see them with the sun hitting them. They're really awesome.
Kay, people can come out and see what's been done to date to get an idea of how this will look when it's completed, right?
Right. Amanda's talking about the S-Line Rail Trail, which is existing and which the La Villa Link will connect to. And we have a quarter mile of that we call our biodiversity corridor as a showpiece for what's possible along the trail.
Nice. Okay, so with all of that said, you've got an event coming up this weekend, the Vistar Emerald Trail 5K to benefit Groundwork Jacksonville. How can people take part?
Well, what we would love for them to do is right now we have just over 400 registrants. We are limiting it to 500. We'd love to meet that goal. So just by visiting First Place Sports or even the ViStar website, you can find links to register for the race. And what's great is we're opening it up to just run, walk, or bike. So whatever your passion is, whatever your mode of transportation is, come on out and check it out. The weather looks great. It's supposed to be a nice 64 degrees, partly cloudy. I mean, we really couldn't have asked for more favorable forecast. And, you know, COVID has certainly put a kink in things this year. We've rescheduled once or twice. But it's really important that we have and hold this race. We need people out and about, get them out in the sun, give them something to do, and that's what this trail will really do.
And this is kicking off Saturday morning on the lawn of the Duval County Courthouse at 8 o'clock. As you said, you can register at firstplacesports.com or at the ViStar CU website. Still time to sign up. And, you know, Kay, so many events have been virtual for so long. It's nice to see one that's actually going to happen in real life with actual people out together, but distanced.
Yeah, it is. And I think that what cities have found during the COVID time is how important their outdoor resources are. So this is an example of that. And can I just say, like, Amanda understanding what this trail will bring to the city is why Groundwork loves ViStar Credit Union.
Well, thank you both, ladies. Again, register at First Place Sports or at the ViStar Credit Union website for this weekend's ViStar Emerald Trail 5K. It will benefit Groundwork Jacksonville and help them complete the Emerald Trail, a green belt that will go all the way around the city of Jacksonville. When it's done, you'll be able to walk, bike, rollerblade throughout the city in this incredible new pathway that will link up neighborhoods and businesses and green up the urban core. So thank you, K.E. House, CEO of Groundwork Jax, Amanda Crawford with ViStar. Going to be a great event. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thanks. Have a good one.
In a moment, another event to tell you about, the St. John's River Keepers annual oyster roast. It's going to be a little different this year. We'll get a taste after this.
Today in music history, November 17th, 1980, John Lennon releases Double Fantasy. I'm David Luckin. Hear John Lennon on Anthology on the WJCT app and
89.9 HD3. Nobody likes to deliver bad news, I know, but the virus doesn't care.
The day that I had to call and tell them we were going to put this on hold, that was a hard call.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, putting a hold on big construction projects and what that means for workers and businesses in Houston. We'll tell you next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6 on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Robin Young. A fever can be one of the first signs you've contracted COVID-19. And if you're using a smart thermometer, you'll not only be helping yourself, but you may be helping public health officials track the spread. We'll touch base again with the makers of the Kinza thermometer to see what they see in their data. Next time, here and now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
Mm-hmm.
Once scorned by Republican leaders, Donald Trump has made the party his own, inspiring fear among GOP leaders and candidates who dare to cross him. But what happens when Trump leaves the White House? On the next Fresh Air, we speak with New Yorker staff writer Nicholas Lemon about his article, The Republican Identity Crisis After Trump. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
How do you square the need to stay home and stay safe with all the things we love about Thanksgiving?
Simply put, we have to rethink these holidays.
Millions are longing to check in on parents and old friends, but is no plan your best plan for the family festivities next week? I'm Jen White. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, the St. John's River Keeper is holding a beloved fall tradition once again this year. It's their annual oyster roast. It's a very popular and tasty affair. This weekend, you can still enjoy oysters and a lot of other great food and fellowship, but in a brand new way. It's going to be a drive-in roast. You take it all in from the comfort of your car. I got a little more information with Jimmy Orth of the St. John's River Keeper. Take a listen. Hey, Jimmy, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So we're living in a world of virtual events and drive-in events right now, and that includes the St. John's River Keeper's annual oyster roast coming up Friday. This is a drive-in event this year, so how is this going to work?
Well, I'll tell you, Melissa, the oyster roast, we're now in our 19th year of having this event, and it's such a social event, something that's kind of become a tradition for a lot of people to attend every year. And we just were racking our brains, how in the world can we actually turn this event into a virtual event? And we found there was no way. So I actually went to one of Sunray's drive-in movies, and I said, this is the formula. So what we're going to do, we're going to have a big screen up just like you would at a drive-in movie theater. Cars are going to park, and people can either sit in their cars or they can sit right outside their cars and safely social distance. And we're going to deliver the food right to their cars and then provide a program up on the screen and have a couple of bands playing while they're eating. It should be a lot of fun.
And we're talking your typical traditional oyster roasts on the menu, all at the fairgrounds. This is being done at the downtown fairgrounds. And you just want everyone to drive in, relax, and enjoy the fun, it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly. We just thought this was one of the only ways we could have a safe and fun event where people could come together and could socialize from a distance, at least be there together, to celebrate the St. John's River, celebrate the work of St. John's River Keeper, to continue to try to protect the river and advocate for a clean and healthy river. And so it should be a fun night. It's not going to be quite the buffets that we usually have at the Oyster Roast or the all-you-can-eat oyster bar, but this year we will be providing the food to you at your, so you don't have to leave your car and the area around your car, and you can safely distance and have a good time and enjoy the evening. It's supposed to be wonderful weather, too.
Great. And so can you explain a little bit about how your tickets, when people buy tickets for this great event, that it will further the work that you do at the River Keeper?
Well, I'll tell you what, the oyster roast has become such a popular event on an annual basis that it is now so important to our annual budget. It provides about a quarter of our budget each year. So it's so important to fund our general operating so that we can continue the important advocacy, education, and outreach programs that we do to raise awareness about the river, to advocate on behalf of the river and raise awareness, engage the public in the process of protecting the St. John's.
With the pandemic and everything else that's gone on this year, environmental concerns, they might have fallen by the wayside for some people. What's your message to everybody out there who hasn't been following this closely? Why is it important to for this community to continue to protect the health of the river?
Well, I think, you know, one thing that's interesting is what we've found is that during this pandemic, people have turned to nature to provide to get away from the stress of being cooped up inside. And people have looked to that for their mental health. And so people enjoy getting out, walking in a park or walking along the river. So it's really important for our health, our mental health, but it's also so important to our economy and our quality of life in Jacksonville. If we don't have clean water, if we don't have a clean and healthy river, it's really going to hurt both our quality of life and our economy locally. And so it's critical that we have, we can't lose sight of the fact that we have to protect the river, and we can't allow ourselves to go backwards in terms of protections for it.
So everyone just go to stjohnsriverkeeper.org, get your tickets now for their annual oyster roast. It's a drive-in oyster roast this Friday night at the fairgrounds downtown. Jimmy Orth, good to hear your voice. It sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. Thanks so much.
It should be. And Melissa, one thing real quick. We are going to stop selling tickets on Wednesday. We may sell out before then, but we have limited capacity, so I really encourage everybody to get them quickly. We're also, though, this year going to offer a virtual option for those people that don't feel safe or feel like they can attend in person. Then they can join virtually, and that, there's information about that on our website as well.
Great. Again, it's stjohnsriverkeeper.org. Enjoy, everyone, and that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. Lots of stories online at wjct.org. Keep that feedback coming. We love your emails. Send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed any part of today's show, you can catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock on the radio, or our podcast will be up later today, wherever you listen. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News, 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow as we'll cross the state line and get an update on just what's happening in the Peachtree State with those all-important runoffs for the two Senate seats in Georgia. How will that affect the balance of power in America? That's tomorrow. Have a great day, everyone. We'll talk to you then.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.